Thanks.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. So as you see, the title of the talk is Hydro Instabilities in the Ohmic Dead Zone in Protoplanetary Disks and Dwarf Novae. Because here we have two fields, basically, like two communities working on a problem that seems can be ported from one system to the other one. So let's see how we can communicate between these two fields. I'm going to show work here that was done in different institutes through my career so far. Max Planck, AMNH, and JPL. And I'm currently at Cal State and in Northridge. These are some of the collaborators here that helped me do this work. And I'm acknowledging here my current sources of funding too, from NASA and from STSI. So the outline of this talk, I'm briefly going to mention the MRI and active and dead zones that we have, if the disk is active or not to it, and the thermal hydro instabilities that were found in the protoplanetary disk literature in the past 3 years, in the past few years. Also, secondary mechanisms to convert the results from these instabilities into a cascade and turbulence, and how these results can be applied to the Dwarf Novae case in the end. So I would like to start with this. It's a fact sheet, basically for people that do not work in the field to have a feeling for the numbers that we deal with here. So then the density in protoplanetary disks ranges from about 10 to the 13 particles per cubic centimeter to 10 to the 15 in, so roughly for two orders of magnitude. Temperature from 10 Kelvin in the outskirts to about 1,000 Kelvin closer to the star. The scales go from 0.1 to 100 AU. And the masses, they typically range from 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 1 times the mass of the sun. The dynamical times, they can vary from 10 to the minus 2 to 10 to the 3 years. And these disks, they usually last for about 1 to 10 million years. When you the Dwarf Novae disks, so Omer helped me do this figure here. The same fact sheet here for the Dwarf Novae case. The density then is much higher, closer to air density. In fact, going from 10 to the 17 to 10 to the 19 particles per cubic centimeter. Temperature are much hotter too, ranging from 1,000 to 100,000 Kelvin. The scales are much shorter though, from about 0.01 AU to even less so than that, 10 to the 9 to 10 to the 11 centimeters. The masses are very low also. These are non-self-gravitating disks, ranging from 10 to the minus 9 to 10 to the minus 8 the mass of the sun. The dynamical time scales are also very different. The dynamical time is in the time scale of hours, and the viscous time is from weeks to months. And both these disks seem to harbor what we call dead zones. So dead zones are regions where the MRI is not active. In the protoplanetary disk case, this is the schematic view. If you want to have the MRI, you need to have both magnetization, the magnetic fields, and the ionization to couple that to the ambient disk. You're going to have that in the inner disk where the temperatures are very high. So you can ionize alkali metals, and you will have that also in the outer disk, where X-rays from the star can reach all of the way through because the density falls quite low. I guess Richard's email just arrived. Thanks. So So you can have the necessary magnetization in the inner disk and in the outer disk. But in this inner region here, the densities are going to be too high and the temperatures are going to be too low to allow ionization either way. This region is not going to couple to the magnetic fields and therefore will be dead to the MRI. And this is what happened when I ran a simple that's on a model based on that. So the magnetic field in this case was not solved for. This was a 2D model with viscous flow where you would expect the MRI and no viscous flow in the dead zone. So you see that in the boundaries you have these billows forming and turning into something else. So there was something interesting happening there in these dead zones, at least in the borders between the active zone and dead zones. So this turns out to be the so-called Rossby wave instability, which is basically the form that the Kelvin-Helmholtz instability has in these disks when you have differential shear.
When you have shear, when you have differential rotation.
So then you can see here in the atmosphere, basically, whenever you have two fluids, and in this case, when you have excess shear, you can convert the shear into vorticity as a mode in the interface. This part here will go faster than this part, so then this part takes over, and then will roll over and generate these billows. It's a way, as I said, to convert shear into vorticity. And this is a phenomenon that happens everywhere. You see vortices in the atmospheres of giant planets, in hurricanes, in the atmosphere of Earth, also if you happen to live in the East Coast, not much here. But here also you see in the ocean, in the form of whirlpools. And here, one of the most beautiful phenomena in fluid mechanics, which is a von Karman vortex street of flow past an obstacle where vorticity gets generated at the boundary, and then you see vortices in the flow downstream. And here then, you see that happening in the atmosphere also. Flow past an obstacle where, in this case, the obstacle is the Taylor column of air above this island. And you see here then the vertex is straight past it in the cloud pattern. So, good. That was what I did first in 2D, but then the question is, does it happen also when you have a magnetization? So in this case, we had an inner active zone where you have the magnetization, and the outer disk in this case was resistive. So this is a model of the very inner disk, the inner 0.1 AU, where you have magnetization in the inner disk due to thermal ionization collision between molecules and the alkali metals. The outer disk, then you already have the dead zone. You see here then that in the boundary between these two zones, you do have this Kelvin-Helmholtz billows forming and then generating this massive vortex in the interface between them. When you look at the quantity, so this is in time here, you have the density, the vorticity, and magnetic energy. Three orbits, five orbits, and 50 orbits. So you can see here that the magnetic energy is quite well confined to the active zone, as we expected. And in the dead side of the transition, you see here this increase in density at later times, which is shown here, very well correlated with a minimum in vorticity, a coherent minimum. So yeah, this is a vortex that formed there. When you measure the alpha values, you find that in the active zone, you have alpha values of about 10 to the minus 2, right?
combined one, magnetic plus kinetic, approaching maybe 5 × 10⁻². And in the dead zone, you also have a large non-zero alpha value, in this case, around 10⁻², also.
So what is it about the boundary between the active and dead layers that is sourcing this instability?
Right, so what happens then in this case is that you have the viscous flow, right? It's bringing mass to it. So you have an accumulation of mass in the border between the dead zone and active zone. So this accumulation of mass behaves as a maximum of vorticity, and this will trap the Kelvin-Helmholtz modes. And then some of these modes, when trapped in this well, they find resonance with each other, and that's what leads to Rossby wave instability.
I'm sure this is dumb, but the mass is being built up because it's coming from the inner zone.
Right.
They're picking up angular.
Well, basically, what you need here is a viscous gradient, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. If you have an active zone and in the outside and that zone in the inside, that's what will happen. Yeah, accumulation of mass. But in this case, it happens also because you have the gradient in viscosity pushing mass to and leading to this vorticity bump. Right, so that was for the inner part, right? The question is, what would happen then in the outer part, right? You also have that dead zone, then in this case, will extend up to 30 AU, more or less. So the structure of the disk in this case would be that you would have in the inner disk a dead zone. The active zone would be here, and then you'd have a transition zone between them. People never bothered actually to look if that zone would be unstable, because the transition then would be quite smooth. So in the inner disk, that's quite sharp, right? Because that's a quantum effect. Either you have energy to ionize the alkali metals, or you don't. In this case here, it's a gradual decline of X-ray luminosity reaching the mid-plane. So that would happen here. This is a log scale. It would happen between 10 AU and 30 AU. So this would be too smooth to generate Kelvin-Helmholtz instability. We need sharp gradients to generate Kelvin-Helmholtz indices. But I modeled it anyway. What would happen in this case? So in this disk here, you have an inner dead zone and an outer active zone. And if you wait long enough, I wasn't looking for it, but if you wait long enough, you have this pesky vortex there, also in the interface between them. And it didn't matter how wide I made the resistivity gradient in this case, you still had that there. So you see here, there is a big difference between hydro models and MHD models in this case. That's a word of caution to people running alpha models. Not always you get the same thing when you run hydro with alpha or when you run MHD. It's common lore in the disk community, or was up to here, that if you had transitions only up to 2H, where H is the scale height of the disk, you would have the Rossby wave instability in that zone boundaries. So these dashed lines here mark the transition of two scale heights. So here then you had the viscous jump being sharp, so you had the vortex there. As you widen it, nothing happens. So no vortex in here, none here, definitely none in here either. because the jumps here were wider than two scale heights. In the MHD case, it doesn't matter how wide you make the resistivity jump. It can be 2H, it was 4H, 8H, 16H. You still have some vortex going on there. So the behavior clearly is different between the two cases, and it's set to explain why. And it seems that what is going on is that it's intuitive, actually, when you find it out. It doesn't matter what the resistivity jump is. What matters is what the jump in Maxwell stress is. And in this case, even though this jump here is quite wide, the jump in Maxwell stress will still be quite sharp, because you always pass from Reynolds number equal to 1 to Reynolds number being less than 1 at some point. When that happens, you pass from having the MRI to not having it. So that's what is shown here. These are models run by Sano and Stone, showing here the magnetic Reynolds number. Whenever you cross the one threshold, you shut off here the stresses. So this seems to be what is happening there.
I thought papers like Fleming and Stone showed there is a dependence of alpha on resistivity, even above the critical value.
On alpha, yes.
And so alpha being also proportional to the Maxwell stress.
You will have a different value of alpha, but you still pass from half, which is what you can see here, right? I mean, like it doesn't go to zero, right? But goes to a value much less than what you had when the Reynolds number was bigger than the one. And that is enough here to trigger this effect.
Okay, so you're just saying that the Maxwell stress is still reasonable above. Okay. Mm.
So, can you say active zone, by the way?
Yes.
You were saying earlier that, well, especially with the sketch of the transition, really there's always a bit of an active zone, namely at the top, right?
At the top, yes.
So I guess I'm a little confused why there's, so don't you have really in reality a vertical gradient in alpha?
These are unstratified disks.
Yes.
These are unstratified disks. So I didn't put here the stratification of the disk.
And so do you think that will make a difference in reality? I mean, like, will the 3D-ness matter?
Well, in this case, then you would have a transition in... what you're saying here is that even in the dead case, right, you would have an active zone, right, in the upper parts. How this active layer would behave for the Rossby wave has been investigated in viscous models. Basically, it will lead to a viscous lead on the vortices. But the overall dynamics will be the same in the mid plane.
So the reason I was confused a little bit is because it sounds like what you're saying is that the reason why it doesn't matter in the MHD case is because essentially what matters is the stress.
Yes.
The stress is sharp.
That's correct.
And I guess what I'm wondering is, that sounds to me like it's a statement about, I can see that for an unstratified disk, but isn't there always going to be isn't that going to get smoother and smoother because there's a vertical scale, which basically the stress is actually not even, actually, it's also a function of z anyway, and basically that will change as a function of radius.
What would be is smoother? What did you mean by that?
He's saying, I think, that there will still be some Maxwell stress at high altitude.
Yes, surely.
And so you're not going to zero out the magnetic field and the
resistance. Oh, average it out, yes.
Yes, yeah, I mean,
vertically average, yes, indeed. But these motions here are quite 2D. So what's happening in the mid plane doesn't depend much on what happens on other layers.
the Rossby wave. Sorry.
But then you get vertical shear, right?
Surely, yeah. Yeah, vertical shear will do something else. Yes. But the Rossby wave instability itself is 2D. I mean, it has been shown in 3D that it will behave quite much like it will do in 2D models. Okay. So that's what happens in the boundaries between active and dead zones. But we see here that these boundaries are quite far apart, right? Say from 0.1 AU to 30 AU. So another question is, what happens then in the bulk of the dead zone? So that question has been a central question in protoplanetary discus in the past few years. And the answer I'm going to give you here, these are the three main instabilities that were found in the past few years in protoplanetary disks. The vertical shear instability, the convective over instability, and this here, the zombie vortex instability. I'm going to go briefly through these three. I'll spend more time actually on one of them, which is the convective over instability. So the sketch of it is what you see here. Basically, is what you have when your disk looks a bit like a star, when you have entropy gradients, basically, in the radial direction. So here, then, imagine that the star was here in the center here. This is a wedge of the midplane of the disk. So you have here that these orbits have hotter gas than these orbits out there. So if you have some gas parcel rising up here from these hotter orbits to colder ones, as it reaches up there, it will have a hotter temperature than the ambient gas, right? Having a hotter temperature than the ambient gas, in this lag here, it will thermalize. As it thermalizes, when it reaches here, it has the same temperature as the ambient gas, but now it will be denser than ambient gas. Therefore, it will sink back to the orbit where it was before. When it reaches this orbit here, now it will be colder than ambient gas in this orbit, and then in this lag, it thermalizes back to the temperature that it had, and closing then the cycle, right? So what happens then in this case is that you have a temperature gradient both in the radial direction and two here in the azimuthal. These two gradients will generate a baroclinicity. So you see here that we need two things. We need first the radial entropy gradient, which is this one that established the buoyancy. And you need finite cooling time, which is for giving the thermalization in these two legs here. When you have these two things, then the... Yes,
so the sure. Thing I don't understand about this argument about the physical origin of this instability is that it's completely neglecting the epicyclic frequency, the specific angular momentum gradient restoring. I mean, entropy gradients are not the only thing for buoyancy in the radial direction.
Yes, right? Yes, yes.
So what am I missing?
In this case here, it was non-linear, right?
Oh, it's finite amplitude, okay.
In this case here, yes.
I'll grant it.
But actually, I'm going to get soon, actually, to the linear version of this. So in this case here, you see that we have angular momentum transport also. You can measure the alpha values, and they are of the order of 5 times 10 to the minus 3. That's the orange curve. And the angular momentum transport here is actually done by waves generated by the vortex, as you can see here. So here is the vorticity, and here is the stress.
So most of it is actually carried in the wake, in fact. So answering Omer's question, this instability actually is linear when you consider z motions, kz wave numbers. If you do that in 2D, you don't have a linear instability. You must do that in 3D. And you see here that when you solve the equation for the perturbations, you end up with a growth rate that is proportional to the square of Brunt-Weissler frequency and also of kz, the vertical wave number. That's actually what took so much time to find out, because you know, you try 2D models first and then you pass to 3D. It's only when you pass to 3D that this thing comes out here. So the linear instability depends basically on the sign of the square of the Brunt-Weissler frequency. So you can translate that into density gradients and temperature gradients. That's basically the entropy gradient. So it will be stable in this region of the diagram and unstable here. We can make that simpler if we consider channel flows, right? So channel flows would have k equal to kz, so radial wave numbers not allowed then in this case, the channel flow. And if you are in capillary motion, kappa squared then would be equal to omega. And if you make that much, much bigger than the Brunt-Weissler frequency, the growth rates and cooling times would become like this. So this is the cooling time that maximizes the instability, and this is the maximum growth rate that you get from it. So that's quite low, actually, because the Brunt-Weissler frequency is usually not that big. So Henrik Leider looked at that also in some detail and found here this curve also. So this is how the growth rates, which is this S curve here, depends on the wave number. And this is a sketch of the stability. Basically, what happens is an overstable epicycle. So you have epicyclic motion, right? And then due to buoyancy, that motion, its amplitude will get amplified as it moves here from S to S1. So as it goes to colder, it loses entropy. So then here it will be pushed a bit further up. And in this leg here, it will gain entropy. So it will be pushed to colder orbits as it reaches S2, and then this thing keeps going, and you amplify amplitudes in this case.
And you require a finite thermal conductivity here.
Exactly. Yes, that's because if it is isothermal, you will never be able to be buoyant in first phase, and if it is adiabatic, it will never thermalize in this leg. Basically, that's what happens. So, what happens then when you have both, right? When you have both convective over instability and also the MRI. So, this is a purely hydro case, and this is here when you put a magnetic field. So, this vortex was happily going there for a long, long time. Once you put a magnetic field, the whole box goes turbulent immediately. And these are the stresses. So here then, you only had the convective over instability. Here then, you put the magnetic field. That's this line here. Then suddenly here, then within three orbits, you have the MRI. So the Maxwell stress here is about four times bigger than the Reynolds. That's just pure an MRI. So basically from this figure, we conclude that the convective over instability will play no role when you have magnetic fields already there. So
the dead zone will change, the active zone will not. Everybody is happy, good. And we can examine the next instability. So the zombie vortex instability. First of all, what is it? It's a horrible name. Yeah. So Phil Marcus, right? I saw this webpage here where it was quite saying this. So because vortices arrive from these dead zones, and because a new generation of giant vortices march across these dead zones, we affectionately refer them to as zombie vortices. Right? This is being recorded, right, Phil? Sorry, but yeah, the name could be better. Yeah, but yeah, great work. But anyway, so what happens here? You can start from a mode here in the disk. In this case, a nonlinear mode, right? But this nonlinear mode here will find resonance with a critical layer elsewhere in the flow.
What's X and Y there?
X and Y as in a shearing box. Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, you have here this perturbation. So the Rossby frequency of this this perturbation here will find a resonance with a buoyancy frequency elsewhere in the flow. So this will excite the critical layer basically through resonance, and then once this here is excited, if you can maintain also the original perturbation, it will trigger other critical layers, and this thing will keep going. So basically, one critical layer will infect the other one, that will infect the other one, and then you have this thing going on.
So
it's a cascade. Yes.
Sorry for continually interrupting, but the frequencies that are resonating off of each other are what precisely?
The epicyclic frequency of the original perturbation, yeah, with the buoyancy frequency elsewhere.
I see.
Yeah. So this is a version of Kelvin's cat eye critical layer. So you have vortices here, right? And then so K here is the vorticity. 2C, the separation from one vortex to the other one. The flow then goes with the velocity given by K over 4C. If you have in the fluid a wave motion that has this velocity here, a wave motion whose phase velocity goes with this velocity, you will have a resonance, and then a critical layer will be excited. The point here is that it's quite hard to excite isothermal critical layers. It's much easier to excite baroclinic critical layers. That's what Phil saw here in this case. So it's a cascade of baroclinic critical layers, and that sets actually one constraint on this. The disk has to be quite adiabatic. The cooling time has to be quite large so that you can keep the critical layers baroclinic within the time that it takes the instability to grow. If the disk cools too fast, you go back to isothermal critical layers, which are quite hard to excite. Right? And the vertical shear instability, right? So the vertical shear instability comes from the fact that you have vertical shear, as you could guess. So if you solve here what the rotation profile is, in the case that you have the mid-plane density falling like this, and the temperature falling like this, you find that
the rotation profile will have one term proportional here to Q, which is the power law exponent of the temperature times Z squared over H2. So this term here depends on Z. So you have d omega dz not being equal zero, that's a vertical shear. And if you only had this, kz, so that k here being the epicyclic frequency, which of course in z isn't really epicyclic motion, but the analogy holds here, this profile then would be really unstable if kappa squared is less than zero, right? So in galactic dynamics, instead of kappa z, if I recall, they use nu, right? Which is in Trimane and Trimane in chapter 2. But that, of course, cannot be the whole case, because we also have entropy. Entropy will give us the Sober-Hoyland criterion, right? So it's not only kappa square going negative, it's actually kappa square plus n square here, the Brunt-Weissler frequency also going, so their sum going to zero. What it means here is that entropy can make this motion here go either unstable or is stable. So if you have that only kappa square here goes negative, if you can have a situation where n square here will bring it back to stability. So what you need to do to keep the situation unstable is to try to cancel the Brunt-Weissler frequency, which means to make the disk more isothermal. So we have these three mechanisms that depend very differently on the cooling time. So vertical shear, you need to keep the disk more or less isothermal. The convective over a stable case is omega tau, the cooling time roughly one orbit. In the zombie vortex instability, you need to make the disk quite adiabatic for it to operate. So, if you take a minimum mass disk, this is the synthesis that you can do from these three instabilities. So, the zombie vortex will occur whenever you have adiabatic situations. The convective over instability will happen through when the cooling time is finite, say between 0.1 to 10, and then the zombie vortex. And then the VSI will kick in here when the disk is more isothermal. And as you go up in the disk, you get to regions where the gas is more optically thin, which also increases the cooling time, so that you get here then the zombie vortex coming back in the outer parts of the disk, in the very, very outer part, if the disk was ohmic, dead all over the place. So this was for the minimum mass. You can also think about other disk models. That's what was done here in this case. So here you have the Rossland opacities. Here you have the snow line of the disk, so about like 40 AU. You can convert that to thermal times. This is what you have. And then you can make this map here for any disk model that you have. Right, so how to bring back then to the Dorfanovy case? So the cooling times in this disk here would be roughly of 10 orbital orbital periods. So the situation in this case seems that if any of these instabilities will be there, it will most likely be either the convective over instability or the zombie vortex one. I think that the cooling time being that high, it will rule out the vertical shear instability. But maybe there are regions in the disk where there can be back, can be brought back. In any case, there is one interesting thing that one can see here from this cartoon also, is that this disk has tidal deformation. This has been shown, right, to lead, in the Dorfinovi case, to accretion through these spiral arms. And that's also something that is seen not in protoplanetary disks, but in circumplanetary disks. So disks around planets where moons form. In this case, and we have the tides from the star that would lead them to this motion, these spirals. In this case here, the problem seems to be that the scale height used was a bit too high. So in this case here, they used the scale height of about 0.1, and this was about 0.15, and this equal also to that. Whereas the scale height in this disk must be much, much lower than that. And if you lower the scale height, then the spiral arms will be less tightly wound, well, more tightly wound, and then you don't have the same alpha values. Still, the tidal deformation may lead to elliptic instability, which is a hydrodynamical instability of a elliptical flow. So whenever you have elliptical flow, like close the elliptic string lines, you may have a resonance between modes in this flow that will lead to a parametric instability. So the way that I the way that it can be this video is not playing. I should have updated this. So the idea here is that you can decompose elliptical motion between a rigid rotation and a strain field, right? So the rigid rotation is stable, right? It's unconditionally stable. The strain field, not necessarily so. You can destabilize the strain field. And that's what's happening here. So when you have ellipticity, which is what's being measured here, chi, the theta here is the angle that the wave vector does with the z direction. So the wave vector here would be pointing in the direction of this blue line here. And the z here is the black line. So you have instability whenever you have the streamlines here not being circular, which is measured by chi here, and when you have a 3D motion. So omega here in this case must be not equal to zero, meaning that if it was zero, you would have basically only a KZ wave mode. In this case, then you have other modes too. So yeah, you see here that you don't have growth when you have chi equal to one. So that's rigid rotation. But when you have ellipticity, you have growth rates here that are positive. And that's what happens here to these string lines when this instability kicks in. And there is also a magnetic version of this mechanism, which happens, of course, when you have magnetic fields. So this here measures the magnetic field, and these are the growth rates. So the hydroversion happens when you have the magnetic field here being zero, right? So here, yeah, for zero field, you see here these two cases where you have no zero growth rate, which are equivalent to chi here being equal to 2, so aspect ratio equal 2, and here aspect ratio equal 3. In this curve here is the MRI curve when you have infinite aspect ratio. So infinite aspect ratio, you are back to shear flows. Right. But for other aspect ratios, you have even higher growth rates, actually, than you get from the MRI. So in conclusion, I will put my conclusion in graphical form. We have three primary mechanisms that depend on the cooling time, right? The secondary mechanism by which they decay, and the end result is, and always, the downscale anisotropy cascade. So I'll stop here, and I will ask questions now. Thank you. Yes, question?
So just following on from this morning, so if I wanted to distinguish between this and the MRI and say a white dwarf disk.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any observation you can think of? I mean, should I be looking for vortices somehow? Is that what you would say would be the thing that one ought to look for?
If we should be looking for vortices, that would be great.
What else?
From what I gather, right, you cannot look. The observations of dwarf nova are not yet at the stage where you can get the detail on the spatial distribution, right? But the QPOs actually could be that there are some observations in protoplanetary disks that are being interpreted as vortices near the inner edge. They kind of look like QPOs in a way. I mean, like they are dippers. That could be that. So if the same thing is happening in dwarf nova, would be interesting to model what vortices would do in this case, and if it would lead to something like QPO. It's in the inner disk, about 0.1, so time scales of a couple of days. So
the relevant time scale is dynamical or thermal?
Dynamical. Yeah.
So in CD disks, that's like seconds potentially.
Something like that, yeah. Yeah, that's what I showed in the first slide, yeah. I mean, in one of the first slides, yeah.
That's orbital period.
Yeah, hours, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's out of disk, yeah.
Okay. All right.
Mm. So, can I ask you to speculate on it? So one thing that I've always wondered in X-ray binaries, where the standard model for state transitions is a radiatively efficient, geometrically thin disk transitioning into a hot, relatively radiatively inefficient flow. And that transition has always struck me as a site for interesting QPOs. Now, this is fully ionized. MRI is probably acting in space. So which of these hydrodynamic instabilities can survive the presence of magnetic fields, if any?
The Rossby wave, there has been claims that the Rossby wave can. If you ask Richard Lovelace, sorry?
Did you say can or
it can? Yes.
Can.
It can, yes. Of all these ones that I've seen, that's the Rossby wave instability that can tolerate magnetic fields. I can show the video here that Richard. Yeah. This is here the VSI, so that's what the vertical shear does to the disk if you have more isothermal case. Thanks, Richard, for the video.
And you need an extreme amount of vortexity? What's the criterion for the RWI?
RWI, yeah, it's you need an extreme moon in vorticity.
Vorticity, yeah.
Yes, exactly. A rule of thumb is that you can have it whenever the density changes by about 20% over 2 square heights.
So I like the picture that I guess Henry Flatter put forward for the convective overstability. Now it makes more sense to me. Is that the nonlinear version or
that's the linear version?
So where does the third dimension come in then, right? Because you said
it's from the KZ. It's in incompressible, right? So the motion happens in the mid plane, but it's like two layers, like one doing this and the other one doing this.
Okay, maybe I haven't looked at this figure long enough to see that. But
so that's one layer. Put another figure out of phase on top of it.
Yes.
And do you need thermal energy exchange between those two layers? Is that where the KZ is coming from? This is a good question.
That's what I want to know, yeah. I don't understand why it's a KZ in the problem either.
It's what?
I don't understand why there's a KZ in the problem either, because it's not obvious on that picture. They're not talking to each other. I mean, they're just independent layers.
Maybe that's something for
us. So these are like inertial modes, which they have point charges.
Are you looking it up? Or?
Horizontal.
No, I'm looking at another.
Why there's a KZ in the problem isn't obvious to me at all.
Ah, here, right, okay. So that's the video that I didn't play. I have actually, hopefully you can see here. So this is a helical wave, right? So this is the wave in X, that's the yellow, the wave in Y. You combine both and you have this wave here. So when this wave here passes through the flow, that's what a gas parcel does. So in 2D, you may have that motion, but you don't have a KZ wave actually propagating through the flow.
Why do you need the KZ wave?
Analytically, you're not gonna get it if you don't have a KZ.
No, no,
press
no.
Yeah.
What is happening along the vertical dimension? Is it that's what is happening along the vertical dimension that's necessary to drive the instability?
Can you go back to the dispersion relation, maybe?
Yeah. So the question is, maybe it is in 2D simulations, but analytically you're not going to get it because you cannot put KZ finite in a 2D, unless you put it. That's an interesting. Interesting point. It was, after all, in 2D cases, in 2D, but we just didn't recognize it.
So see just where the thermal conductivity is coming in. But it's in the last term there.
There's two terms. No, not really. Here?
Oh, no, I see the second term as well, right
here. Is there an axisymmetric version of this?
Sorry?
Is there an axisymmetric version of this?
Yes, that's this actually, yes.
So your circles going around like this on epicycles doesn't work in that case, does it really?
Yeah, that's true that I didn't put KY modes in this case. There are only KR modes and KZ modes.
So the question is whether or not any of this overturning motion is also in the meridional plane as well as just in the horizontal plane.
That's what the KR does. So the KR is hidden here in the K. So the K is KR plus KZ. K is square root of kr square plus kz square.
But you would still get a growth rate even with kr equals 0.
With kr 0, yes. Yeah. So kr equals 0, that's actually the maximized mode. That's a channel flow, yes. So that's the maximum growing mode. That's a channel flow. In saturation, you end up with a mixed mode. But it's the maximum growing one, it's this
this overstable epicycle. Yeah, if you put k is equal to 0, right, so no wave modes, what you're going to have, I mean, you see here from the analytics that there is no growth rate. The kz here is 0, no growth rate, and then the maximum, I mean, the cooling time that maximizes it goes to infinity. So, yeah, analytically shows that there is no growing kz equals 0 mode.
The n squared is just the Brunt Weissauer frequency in the radial direction?
Yes.
And the kappa squared is just the epicyclic frequency.
That's correct.
So it's kind of odd that there's nothing that comes into the equation which has got anything to do with the vertical direction apart from the kz.
Is that the full dispersion relation?
It's the full dispersion,
yeah.
Yes.
Incompressible?
No, it is compressible.
Oh, it's compressible, yeah. It's compressible, but to derive that, I set, in the end, the sound speed equal to infinite, so,
right.
Yeah, to filter out the sound waves. Yes. So it's an elastic, yeah.
Okay, maybe the aficionados can discuss this.